Hi, I'm Vera Farmiga. I play Laura Jaconi in the film Boundaries, and this is Film Wax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Sharkoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 478 of the podcast. Welcome. This is another South by Southwest oriented episode. We have two segments dedicated to the recent South by Southwest Film Festival, and then one with the filmmaker who is based out in Los Angeles named Amir Motlagh. I did want to mention the first film is called Boundaries, and it stars Vera Farmiga. So she will be on the first segment coming up, and she'll be joined by the director of Boundaries, Shauna Festi, as well as one of the other actors in the film named Lewis McDougall. Then we'll have a second segment, a documentary that was at the podcast called Bill Murray's Stories. Bill Murray's Stories, Life Lessons Learned from a Mythical Man. We'll have on director Tommy Avalone, joined by two of his producers, and the second, that's again in the second segment. And then we're in the third segment, we'll have a great low-budge, emerging, experimental filmmaker from Los Angeles named Amir Motlagh join us. And so it's a very robust episode, to say the least. Let's get into the first segment here. The film is called Boundaries. It's a bit of a dramedy, if you will. It has great cast, with the spectacular cast, in fact, headed by Vera Farmiga, but also Kristen Schaal. Bobby Cannavale is in it. Lewis McDougall, who you're going to meet. And, of course, the great Christopher Plummer. Vera Farmiga plays Laura, who is a well-meaning single mother who is forced to drive her estranged pot-dealing father, played by Christopher Plummer, from Texas to California, with her troubled son, Henry. That's our young friend, Lewis McDougall, with her troubled son, Henry, along for the ride, while Jack uses Henry and the road trip to help him distribute his copious supply of marijuana. Laura finally confronts Leonard, her deadbeat ex-husband, Cannavale. It's a terrific little film, I have to say. It's being distributed by Sony Pictures Classics, so we know this film will be coming out soon, but I felt the urgency to get my South by Southwest coverage up and out. I saw this at South By. I enjoyed it very much. We're going to now go into a segment which we recorded right out of Austin at South by Southwest just about a month or so ago. We're going to have the actor Vera Farmiga. We're going to have the actor Lewis McDougall, and we're going to have the director of the film, Shauna Festi, all coming up right now. The name again of the movie is called Boundaries, and it's all right here on Film Wax Radio.
Have you spoken with your father recently?
He called, but I did not pick up.
So you set a boundary.
I do notice you have a kitten hidden in your purse. Were you hiding it from me?
I think our hour is up.
Oh, you finally called me back.
You got kicked out of your home, didn't you?
We can't have men of such low moral integrity bringing down the place.
Oh, please.
Dad needs a place to stay.
Last time Dad stayed with me, the FBI followed me to work for a week.
I would take him, but he's a horrible example for Henry.
Does this mean I'll get to see you guys?
No, I would put him on a plane. I'm not driving that heap cross-country.
But I'd like to spend some time with you two.
Absolutely not.
There's $200,000 worth of weed in there.
I can't unload it on my own.
I'll help you.
Did you change my navigation?
He gave me $20.
Henry! Hey!
Who are these people?
Old friends of your grandfather's.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thanks for your patience. And this is Effrey, who's a very talented filmmaker. He had his last feature at the Tribeca Film Festival this last spring.
Congratulations.
And
hi.
But now he's carrying my luggage. Anyway, I had the pleasure of seeing Boundaries before I got here. So fortunately, I had done my due diligence.
Thank you.
And then it's a fun comedy with I guess, a dramedy, you could also say, right? So we're joined today by the director of Boundaries, Shauna Festi. I got that exactly right?
Totally.
Okay, good.
Which is very rare. Yes, thank you.
We have one of the actors from the film. His name is Lewis McDougall is here, who's one of the actors from the film. He plays Henry. And we have also Vera Farmiga, who plays Laura.
I do.
Who's Henry's mom. No Christopher Plummer, sadly. I did talk to Charlie Plummer.
Oh, that's while I was good here, enough,
do you know
then.
Charlie?
Yeah,
the actor, Charlie, young actor who's in Andrew Haig's film. Anyway, I digress. So now I was told by Gary, the great Gary Springer, that this story, Boundaries, is actually based on actual events from your life, Sean. Is that
it
true?
It is. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's definitely. It's based on my father, mm-hmm. who is an incredibly charismatic, wonderful lawbreaker, and. I think this film for me was just a way of really being able to understand our relationship, our super complicated relationship, and get in touch with some of, you know, the anger that I had repressed for so long, which was crazy and cathartic for me.
Right. Yeah. And that could eat you up. So this was really, catharsis is the great way to put it, right? It's also kind of risky because, you know, how it ends up, representing that story has got to be something that's of great concern to you too, right?
How it
ends up, does it really does it matter even? Because mm-hmm. the process, maybe it's the process that's actually the most helpful to you.
Yeah, I think the process was really helpful. And then, you know, it is about me. And then when you get on to set, it's not so much about me. Then it's, you know, Christopher Plummer and transforming this character right. into something totally different. I mean, Christopher Plummer and my father could not be more different people.
Really?
I mean,
sorry. Yeah.
I was not raised by Christopher Plummer, that's for sure. I would have loved to have been. He's pretty cool.
I would say so, yeah. We were raised in terms of The Sound of Music. But yeah, you know,
exactly.
raised on him, but in the different
room. I don't know. Plumzilla's got a mad twinkle in his eye.
Yeah, he does.
It's remarkable. He just seems to be as, it's like the most mischievous and most sort of
mischievous. He is indeed.
Yeah, that's the voice of Vera Farmiga. Does it end up being more of a challenge to try to represent a real story or. It doesn't matter. Do you feel an obligation or a responsibility to the role in a different way?
Especially given that my director...
She's directing you, yeah.
And the writer is the subject at hand.
Yeah, that's...
I don't really think about it. I don't feel... I suppose I've done that often enough in my career, whether it's a genre film like Conjuring or having to do Lee Hart in the Gary Hart story recently, or I oftentimes have, or Down to the Bone, my first film I ever did, playing a real life model.
Oh, right.
I mean, there is, I think the understanding is that even Shauna writing herself is also embellishing upon her experience and drawing from her experience as a mother now and as a daughter. But also, I think it's a compilation. I don't necessarily think that Laura is you to a T.
I would hope not. I mean, no.
Well, at a certain point, if there's an organic thing that occurs to any character, right?
I don't know. I don't really think about it. I think the script was so delightful and so on point and so strong that I always take the cues from the script, not necessarily studying Shauna and the way she moves or the way she reacts or the way she operates. I'm also bringing my experience in. I mean, I did not have a dad who was a rascal. I had a dad who was a monk. Like, was such a... Not really, not... But okay. I mean, he was not... There was... He was... I was probably the rascal in our relationship. But still, I mean, whether it's your mom, whether it's your dad, whether it's... We always have this untapped anger that we just don't get in touch with. And that, for me, is what resonated most. In making sure that that's at the heart of what's going on with Laura.
Yeah.
Understanding that. And then everything else, I mean, will follow suit. I mean, Christopher Plummer and I have a certain energy together. And Lewis McDougall and I have a certain energy together. So, you know, you tap into that energy as best as you can. And you riff on that, and then it moves, before you know it, moves further and further away, probably from Shauna Feste's experience. But I do think about it, and I don't think about it. I can't think about it too much.
Sure.
I can't
obsess
over that.
Right. And I obviously, as an actor, and a seasoned actor, there's instincts that kick in terms of where the line is and how you deal with that. I understand, right, in terms of that tension or whatever you want to call it. Do you, I guess, Shauna, you must have a son, an actual son?
No, I think Lewis's character is a lot about me. I do have two sons.
Okay.
And I kind of imagined what they might be like when they were older,
uh-huh.
and that inspired Lewis, but also probably Lewis is a lot of me.
So you have two young sons?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Uh-huh.
They're two and four.
They're wee boys.
Yeah, wee.
Were they on the set? Did you meet them?
I didn't meet both of them. I met Ellis, and well, he was very little.
Yeah, when I met him.
I also got to meet Vera's.
He had no choice. I needed babysitters.
I actually helped out coaching her son's soccer team.
So that was
good to get to know everybody really well. And as you said, Shana doesn't actually have a 15-year-old son.
Right.
And so that also, I guess, gave me a bit more freedom to just, just do what I felt was right, I guess.
Yeah, that took that, what we're talking about Laura and Vera, that was not even a part of the equation, because you're kind of a composite plus or whatever. This is a work of fiction based on some real events, so let's get that right. This is not a documentary. So it's a road movie, essentially, and it's a comedy, as I mentioned. There's a lot of wonderful bits, and there's a lot of great character actors you cast in this movie. Sadly, they're not here today. What was the shooting schedule? Was that very relatively brief? Or
it was pretty brief.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was 24, 25 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But was it most? Where did you shoot?
We shot in Vancouver.
Uh-huh.
And then we did some driving stuff down the coast.
Okay.
Afterwards, yeah.
Down the west coast,
yes.
I guess, right?
That and we did sense. A day in Couple, Los Angeles. Yeah.
We did
a day
on the beach.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and is it safe to say that that what's in the car and how much of this is, are we not wanting to divulge?
Oh, spoil. Got it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think about that. Yeah. I don't know. What do you think?
Do you have a, it, well, let's put it this way. The it starts off.
What do you want to know?
Okay, let's put it this way. And we could always edit something. Let's put it this way. The factor, the mitigating factor, whatever you that launches the story is that Christopher Plummer, who's playing Laura's dad, he's Jack. He's thrown out again from the senior residence
he gets kicked out of. His retirement home.
Yeah. Retirement home. And it doesn't sound like it's the first time he's gotten into trouble in that way, potentially. So he now needs a place to live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The deal is that I have an offbeat son who's probably going to be requiring special schooling, which costs a heck of a lot of money.
That's right.
And so the understanding is,
and they borrow money.
And we are estranged from each other in this parent-child relationship with me and Chris Plummer. Where he's a schemer by nature, and if he can scheme up the cash for my son's special,
you'll forgive him. then you'll forgive him.
Not necessarily forgive him, but I'll give him a ride to my sister's 400 square foot apartment where he can live the end of his days.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. That's right. So Christopher Plummer completely game here, right? He's just like
in a trucker hat.
Yeah, great.
Plummer in a trucker hat.
He's willing to do anything.
Oh my god!
Anything you ask.
He's a clown.
Mm-hmm.
He really is.
Yeah, I mean,
with stamina to boot, had more energy than any of us.
I think it was that all his theater background.
Because
we were shooting in an old folks' home, and we had the most lovely day players, and some of them were struggling with remembering a line or two. And for one really lovely woman, we had to write down her line. And here Christopher Plummer was doing 10 pages a day of dialogue and never missing a word.
No.
I mean, he is just a crazy pro, but I think the twinkle in his eye, although he is so different than my father. My father's a Texan. My father's a cowboy.
Right.
He's a little more rough and tumble, but they both have that mischievous twinkle in their eye that is just undeniable.
Right. Now, I understand your father actually was on the set.
He was.
And he plays a...
he couldn't get into Vancouver because he's a felon.
Oh, my God.
So he got to the airport, and then we had to turn him around, and he couldn't come.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So he tried.
He tried. He'll always try.
Yeah. You're right. A little thing like the letter of the law.
A little, yeah. Well, they put him in the LA bit, so he actually has a nice deal with Christopher Plummer.
Right. Also, Christopher Plummer is Canadian.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So there was kind of a Canadian connection there, too.
Yeah.
So did he think, perhaps, that Canada's a little looser with that type of relationship with the United States, that they might overlook the fact that he's a felon?
They didn't overlook the fact that he's a felon.
Well, no, apparently not. But maybe he thought, maybe I can talk my way into talk my way across the border there.
Yeah, he's not as good as he used to be, I guess. It did not work.
So is he missing a lot from your childhood? Was your dad missing a lot?
Yeah, he was in and out of my childhood.
Okay.
You know, just kind of in with a Rolls Royce that he had won in a poker game. And we'd go to, you know, every restaurant and order everything on the menu. And then the next day he'd lose it all on a football game. And we'd be eating Top Ramen and buying lotto tickets. It was like a very up and down childhood.
Right, which is great for childhood, right?
It's super consistent. It was great. Yeah. Really and safe.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Lewis, what's your childhood like as an actor?
Well, I mean, it's pretty normal, I would say, really. I mean,
is it?
I've been back at school. I've not filmed something in like a year or so. So
okay.
But you know, my friends and everything, they treat me normal, like they would if I wasn't in any sort of films. At least I think they are. I mean, it's kind of weird. Sometimes, you know, you have like kids in like the younger years of the school like, might come up to me or something like that, which is kind of funny, I guess. But it's kind of weird watching yourself like grow up on screen and everything. It's an odd experience, but I'm enjoying it. Mm-hmm. So,
How many films have you done today?
I've done four, but. I mean, this one's still to come out, and then the other one that I did still to come out.
Okay.
So,
come to do such a good American accent?
Well, I had a great dialect coach. Really, mm-hmm. that's really what it was. And I guess the fact that you know, in the UK and Britain, we watch as much American television as they do here. So, I've got so many.
You have references.
Influences. Yeah, I can watch something and just. I mean, what I used to do is actually, my dialect coach used to give me like certain actors whose accents I could kind of replicate. So I remember listening to, I don't know, like Jake Gyllenhaal or Leonardo DiCaprio, mm-hmm. and just like repeating what they said just to try and get into the accent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting experience learning an accent, and I've only ever done one film in my own accent. So yeah, but it's enjoyable. Mm-hmm. It's a good skill to have, I guess.
So do you do any impressions?
No, I don't do impressions.
No, it sounds like, because you have to have a very good ear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To,
yeah.
Especially at...
Okay.
Let's hear your Christopher Walken.
Oh, no. See, it's a different story doing it. Fallas. He played my dad in like one of the first films I did. But again... Now I can't do it.
All right, you do it. All eyes on me.
No, I have the same problem.
You do it.
What's
your Chris Walken?
Sometimes
do
I can,
it.
Fallas.
Yeah.
Fallas.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
You know.
Crazy.
I know, it's hard.
Never mind.
Yeah. I did have Dick Cavett. You know, he's here with a documentary. I don't know if you know. There's a documentary about his friendship with Muhammad Ali. And they've made it into a documentary. It's very, really wonderful. And actually, we were with him a couple of days ago. And he had done my... podcast once before because, you know, it's a talk show kind of ish show that I do. I'm not comparing it to the Dick Cavett show by any stretch. But I loved him growing up, you know. And he does a lot of impressions. So we found myself doing like dueling James Masons with him and on the last thing. Anyway, so, well, the name again of the film is is Boundaries, directed by Shauna Feste. And it stars Vera Farmiga. And so name some of the other, and Lewis McDougall, of course, excuse me. And name some of the, Christopher Plummer, but some of the other folks in the film, because I think, you know, a lot of film lovers would love to hear what a great cast you assembled. And
Peter Fonda. Christopher Lloyd.
Not familiar with these guys, but I hear they're good.
Bobby Cannavale.
Bobby, of course. Yeah. Of course, my gosh.
Dolly Wells.
Kristen Scull.
Oh my gosh, right. Mm-hmm. She plays your sister, who we mentioned, who we're trying to get dad to move into her place. And you tapped into Kristen. Is it Kristen? Or Kristen?
I
always screw that up. Kristen. You tapped into her kind of unique character, but used it well here. She
didn't,
you know what I mean? Like, she's a little daffy, but a lot of fun. And you two, you two have a little bit of what would you call it? A musical.
A dance-off?
A dance number, yeah.
A dance presentation.
Where did that come about? Did you actually do that from? With your sister?
Well, did. My sister and I did the oddest thing in that we would, when my father was a bookie for a while, and when he would lose a lot of money in football games, we would then, for no good reason, get in our underwear and put toilet paper around our face, like head as like a ribbon and a hat, and we would do a dance for him. And it was very awkward and horrible, and I tried to capture that in a much better way on screen. But it's completely inappropriate, and I'm sure he thought it was totally inappropriate as well.
He was embarrassed. Dad?
Yes.
Yeah. But again, Mr. Plummer, game. So that's good.
Totally
yeah.
game.
Yeah.
We did not dance in our underwear, however.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. The sequel.
Could be a sequel. Mm-hmm. Very true. But coming from a Jewish family, we're a very small family. I mean, I didn't even know boundaries in the sense of, like, I didn't know, like, it's inappropriate to be so in my business, you know, and until I was with someone who wasn't Jewish. And we were very, you know, making sort of a plan to spend the rest of our lives together. And then she came from a Catholic, larger Southern family where there were lots of kids and people didn't quite, you know, they let them grow up, you know, and then kind of had more of a, hands-off approach to being a parent. So it was a surprise to me, you know, so I kind of could relate, even though your parents were quite different than mine, you know. Where was your mom in all this?
I didn't write my mom. I killed my mom off. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just easier that way.
Yikes.
I don't mean it that way.
I know what you meant. No.
It was a lot. I think my dad takes up a lot of space, and so I just was kind of concerned. And the animals, you know, take up a lot of space. I wanted to fit in all the animals as well.
Oh, right. Yes. One of the other quirks of Laura's personality is she's an addictive adopter of stray animals.
Addictive adopter.
That's a clumsy way of putting it, but what's the right? You can't really help yourself. Laura can't help herself, I should say.
No, she's an animal lover.
Right.
And a savior of animals.
Yeah. There's some pretty cute animals in the film as well. So
one is my own.
Did you enjoy that aspect of it?
It was great. Yeah, I mean, whenever we were filming in the car, you'd be sitting there with about, especially me in the back seat, with about four or five dogs on top of you, and then along with that there would be the sort of wrangler lying down.
Oh, really?
The seats. So it was really it was quite crowded back there, but it was it was good fun, yeah. And as Shanna was going to say, one of the dogs is her own, and Loretta, she's a kind of like small,
mangy little white mutt.
No, it was good fun with all the animals. Yeah.
And was that based on fact too?
Yeah, I mean, that's very true to me, and also trying to shine a light on rescuing animals for me was a really personal thing. But I have a revolving door when it comes to animals, so I usually have about 7 to 8.
Oh, really?
And that idea of Laura, you know, in her bed with 9 animals is kind of my, like, utopia. Like, I see that as just loveliness. And I know when we screened the movie at first and we asked for comments, people were like, is she mentally ill? Why would she be hoarding so many animals? And I'm thinking, oh, she's generous and amazing. Like, what is? And they're like, it's disgusting in her room. I was shocked by those comments because I just thought it was the most amazing, beautiful thing to sleep with that many animals.
Is there a reality series based on animal hoarding? I haven't
been on it. No. I don't know.
Well, we started the conversation. You're talking about the catharsis of maybe telling this particular story, you know. And I wonder if, two things. One is, do you feel legitimately like you've gotten a lot of this kind of worked out, the issues that
I'm all better.
You're all better. Saved a lot of money out there. Making an independent making an independent film is actually probably cheaper than the amount of therapy, therapy that's you want to talk expensive, that nothing is like in making a film. And then also, I guess, is dad. He saw, yeah. Obviously, he's in it, and he participated, and he supported your making this film, which is kind of like a personal thing, and he could be offended or upset by it, but apparently, I mean, I'm wondering what he thought of the film at the end of the day, where he saw it.
I teach at AFI, and I teach screenwriting, or I taught last year, and I always tell my students, you know, write something that you would be nervous about giving someone, because when mm-hmm. they read it, they have to know more about you. And so this film, I wanted to make myself as vulnerable as possible and to write something personal. And I want, my father passed away in June.
I'm sorry.
That was right when we were finishing the film. And I was nervous to show him. Because I didn't want him to see that anger still. So that still was something that I struggle with.
Right.
And so, you know, my family is all coming tonight. They're all supporting me here in Austin.
Right.
But it was a really scary experience writing my father so closely. And even my sister and some of his friends. My sister hasn't seen the movie yet. And I'm definitely nervous about how they'll see it. But, my father unfortunately didn't get to see the film. But I, in a way, I think it's a love letter to him. So,
it's an
angry love letter.
But you know, I had this experience with Finn the other day. My 9-year-old, where he's an even keeled guy, and he's really measured.
Mm-hmm.
But he flipped out, and he's a blue belt in karate, and the master, like, he was using him as an example. He's the youngest blue belt, and he's working towards his red belt, and his master, like, used him as example, but to the point of it hurt. And he, for the first time in his life, he unleashed such vehemence and anger, and it was profoundly scary for me to see. He's such a gentle dude, but he wasn't in this instance. And it was terrifying, but at the same time, I was like, yes!
Yes,
find your voice in the way that Bobby Cannavale's character goes,
Good for you, Mark!
You know, and I think it's healing for him as well. The story was.
Thanks for sharing that. That's a story. Well, again, the name of the movie is called Boundaries, and directed by Shauna Feste. And what's next? I don't even know if I mentioned... And during the course of this conversation that we're here in Austin at the world premiere of Boundaries here at South by Southwest 2018. And can you mention even what's coming up next? Because by the time I put this out into the universe, it'll be after South by Southwest, certainly.
Yeah.
But I can
I'm really thrilled to say I optioned the life rights of the first female rapper from Afghanistan. And her name is Paradise, and I wrote it into a hip-hop musical. So I'm really excited. That's my next project.
I'm there.
All right.
So there. But I was wondering, even also, just in terms of boundaries, like what's is it got more festival? Are you doing more festival?
Oh, got it.
That's that's great to know about,
next,
too.
One, let's next bring me personally. I'm going to have dinner with my husband. No.
Very good.
Sony Classics is releasing it in June.
Perfect. Okay.
And we're going to go to a few more festivals. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is I'm sure I'm in New York.
Okay, great.
I look forward to helping maybe get the word out when Boundaries has its theatrical in there. And I'm sure it'll be also at the, I'm going to guess, Lemley Monica Center or something, some such place in Los Angeles.
Probably.
And Louis, since we did mention Shauna's next project, do you have another role coming up?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was in a movie called The Belly of the Whale about...
The Belly of the Whale.
Belly of the Whale, yeah. It's nothing to do with whales.
It's very biblical, though.
It's a metaphor. It's biblical, and filmed that about almost a year, a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be coming out later this year. And looking forward to that as well, yeah.
Well, if our paths should bring us together again, mm-hmm. you can knock off the phony Scottish accent. And this from Miga, you must have a...
I did a film with John Goodman called Captive State. It's going to be in theaters near you soon. Hugh Jackman and I did the Gary and Lee Hart story, directed by Jason Reitman,
you mentioned
I've
that
with
before.
And on Up in the Air, and Godzilla 2 is coming out. There's a handful of them.
thank you all so much for coming on and finding time to do the podcast. It was a thrill to get to meet you and to have you on the show.
Thanks
for having
us. It's crazy. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Bill Murray Story's Life Lessons Learned from a Mythical Man is one man's journey to find meaning in Bill Murray's many unexpected adventures with everyday people, rare and never before seen footage of the comedic icon participating in stories previously presumed to be urban legend. Whether it be singing karaoke late at night with strangers or crashing a kickball game in the middle of the afternoon, Bill Murray lives in the moment, and by doing so, creates magic with real people. Joining me from South by Southwest, we have on the podcast coming up right now, the director of Bill Murray Stories, Tommy Avalone. And joining Tommy are two of his producers, Max Paolucci and Derek Kunzer. I probably have butchered everybody's names, but I apologize for that. Again, the name of the film, the documentary, is called Bill Murray Stories, Life Lessons Learned from a Mythical Man. And if you are planning to be up in Toronto or Ontario, I have the inside scoop that Bill Murray Stories will be screening at Hot Docs. Anyway, this is my conversation with the director and the producers of this great and entertaining and rather inspiring new documentary about our friend Bill Murray right here on Film Wax Radio. Oh, and please forgive my, we're interrupted a number of times in this segment, and I seem to get a little short, a little hot under the collar, and I'm called out for that. So, I made good with everybody, so don't be too worried for me. Again, here's my conversation with Tommy, Max, and Derek. Film is called Bill Murray Stories.
The Bill Murray Stories, Life Lessons Learned
from the Mythical Man.
From Mythical Man.
A Mythical Man or The
Mythical Man? The Mythical Man.
Let's just start, and anybody can chime in. Don't worry about it. We're with two producers here of the film, the documentary. We have Max. What's your last name, Max?
Max Paolucci.
Paolucci, and we have Derek.
This is Derek Kunzer, cinematographer and producer.
Oh, excuse me. And you shot it.
I should have got his microphone closer to his mouth.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's okay. It's all right. I apologize. We'll double up and, you know, I can fix a lot of stuff.
I didn't want to knock over the coffee.
Please don't knock
keep
anything over.
Keep all this
over.
In.
Yeah. And last but not least, we are, well, actually, we're here also with my co-host, Zephyr Throwell.
Oh, you're too kind. Thank you for including me on that.
Sorry, but especially because he's here to shoot and we're barely done any of it, shooting video for the podcast and for the film. And last, but Tommy Avalone, who is the director, the filmmaker,
yes.
Of
can you hear this dance music in the background? Should we start dancing while we talk to you?
Absolutely.
The bands here at South By are very loud.
And then
and
I will
popping a lock.
Then Jeffrey and I will choose a winner based on your performance.
Sounds good.
And the winner will go to the next step in Las Vegas.
I'm pretty good at the Charleston.
Then you can go to Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah, there you
okay,
go.
Very good.
Good. I like that.
I was at your premiere, I guess, your world premiere.
Oh, awesome. Right?
Was it the world premiere?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
In at the where were we? What theater were we in?
Alamo Draft House.
Yeah, Alamo Draft House, South Lamar. Lamar. The other night, and got to watch it. And to a, I might mention, a sold out crowd.
Yes.
Have you had another screening since, guys?
We're tonight.
Tonight,
4 o'clock.
Second.
Yeah.
Second of three.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, good luck with that. I'm sure it's sold out as well.
It's yeah, it's looking like the pre-sale ones are already out.
The express passes went out. They make them available 24 hours before. Yeah, I think I checked within a minute of that 24 hours before mark, and they were already unavailable.
Awesome. That's great to
hear. Hot ticket.
You may be able to surmise we're at South by Southwest. This is going to sound like a painfully obvious question, but who is Bill Murray?
No, no. Why does it?
What am I doing here? What's going on?
Why? Yeah, exactly. No, but why does everybody know who Bill Murray is? Why is he universally, you know, kidding about who he is? Because everybody does know who Bill Murray is. What makes him so universally appealing? Which will also probably answer why you decided to make a documentary about the same person.
Yeah, I mean, he spans generations. You know, some people like him as the Caddyshack, you know, Bill Murray. We all kind of fell in love with Bill from Ghostbusters. There's also the Wes Anderson type Bill Murray. But, you know, and there's also the social media, him popping into people's lives and making these fantastic stories that our movie's mostly about.
I know the films are quite different, like a Wes Anderson movie from, Ghostbusters film or one of the other blockbusters, let's say. But, I mean, really, truly, how different is the Bill Murray persona regardless, Max?
I mean, I wouldn't consider Bill Murray necessarily a method actor that kind of disappears into a role.
No, but it's not at all.
It's probably a little kind of tweak of the dial here and there from, you know, an everyman kind of approachable person. But I think that's what, when you look at the roles he's accepted, outside of probably a few satellites of Garfield's and such, a lot of them mean a lot to a lot of people because he kind of stays in that lane. And the thing that we kind of figured out when talking to these people is the person that he kind of people believe he is in the movies ends up being the person he ends up being in real life as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we come to be so.
No, we're good. We're trying to think of this movie.
Which one?
I was just saying, because Bill also does these really great jobs of being the secondary character, that guy that kind of pops up in, like, you know, the Looney Tunes, Space Jam. But we're trying to think of the one where he was in with Neve Campbell and Richards, Kevin Bacon,
where he's the lawyer.
He's a great performance there.
Classic with Matt Dillon and
Well, Derek's looking up
the movie with the pool scene.
But let's go back.
Yeah, risque movie?
Yeah.
Let's go back to the first time I saw him.
I was going to try to make a subtle joke about it, but then I couldn't remember what the name of the movie was. So.
Let's go back to, while he's looking that up, let's go back to maybe the first supporting role he's ever had, which I remember, because I'm old enough, I went to the movies and saw Tootsie, where he played Dustin Hoffman's roommate. I think that may have been his first main movie role. I mean, he might have done Meatballs or something.
Yeah, Meatballs was his first
movie.
That was
in Canada.
Right, his first movie.
Did
but then
he do Stripes already?
Yeah, I think Caddyshack might have been before Stripes.
Okay.
I don't know. It's all the same, right? What's time?
But it's just
an idea.
But look how quickly he graduated into major Hollywood movie with the maybe number one movie star at the time, Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah. I mean, the idea, too, is like, you know, once he did Ghostbusters, he knew he could be late to any film set. And that his life is going to be drastically different for the rest of his life.
Right. Exactly. Okay, well, your documentary, though, now we've laid out why Bill Murray is so popular and beloved, and he is.
Because he's an honest guy, too. Like, you could tell, like, he's like...
No, we're not at the moment. We're good, thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Waitress is asking us if we'd like food when we're clearly doing a podcast.
It's all right.
You shouldn't shoo anyone away, though. You're just like, no, sir, I have important things.
No,
ma'am.
Time is of the essence, so... But, you know, we're also at South by... You got to roll with the punches here, right, Zephyr?
Life born under the punches.
You should say sorry to that lady for shooing her away, though.
I know. I will. In the end, tip
your
waitress.
Your mother was obviously never a waitress.
Right. No, I love waitresses. I'm just putting it out there in
obvious.
The universe.
It's not obvious.
Oh. I've been wrist slapped by the Bill Murray documentary team here.
But what I'm saying, though, is like there's an earnest in Bill Murray, and like, you know, he's very relatable. I think Max was saying, like, he plays the common man. He likes to connect with the common man, and I think there's a reason why people gravitate towards him is because
he
has that sort of feeling of, like, I'm just like you, but just famous.
Right. So you wanted to make a movie about these strange, seemingly arbitrary appearances he makes in people's, as we've referenced them, the normal people's lives. He just sort of will potentially pop up one day, maybe in their kitchen, decides to clean their dishes at a frat party, or he'll show up at a dinner party, you know, and we hear different stories over the course of the documentary, first-hand accounts of these things and how they really those appearances really impacted those people's lives, not just that day, but their actual lives, right? You yourself have a personal story? You want to have one of those moments. So well, I mean, you created this movie like as
I didn't start the movie by saying, my name is Tommy Avalone and I want to have a Bill Murray story. You know, like it was a situation where we knew the stories were the star. You know, like we knew the stories were interesting. The stories were fun. And we wanted to make sure we interviewed the people who had those stories. And that's a movie. I think it's all these things. Everyone has an idea, but it's the take, you know. And our take was to follow the stories.
Sure.
And the more we got into it, too, we talk about, and you'll see in our South by Southwest poster, it's a picture of Bill's face on a Sasquatch. It's more of, when we got into the production of this, it was, you know, we want to try to find out the stories, the lore, the legend.
Right, and right.
The more you got into it, it was kind of... The byproduct of what was coming from these people's stories was the heart and soul of what I think he wanted it to be as well. The actual message lies in the actions and their interpretation of it,
right.
Which I think is the ultimate strong takeaway. Right. But the best part is, like, it's still interpretive to each person in that audience, you know, what they take away from it as far as how it could affect them and kind of seeing these moments.
Yeah.
We're on a boat right now. We're pretty busy. I don't know if you guys are going to order stuff.
Give us 5 minutes.
Yeah, they're going to order.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll text Blair.
Yeah, that's probably a wise thing to do. But while we're talking to Max, if the Sasquatch could talk, you know, and somebody saw Sasquatch, the Sasquatch would probably say something along the lines of, no one will ever believe you saw me or this happened. So that's kind of the
yeah, but
the
I wouldn't want to talk to the Sasquatch also hear about what it's like to just run in the woods all night. Like, it's more fun kind of talking to the people around the side.
But
of
there
it.
Is a you are involved in a project which is about people that are, let's say, enamored and sort of obsessed sort of with Bill Murray. And
sure.
There is a subculture that feels that way about Sasquatch, about Bigfoot.
I wouldn't say we it's necessarily enormous. Kind of got into a culture of people that were obsessed with them either.
I know, the right term.
The thing we really tried to avoid was, like, it's not a fandom
picture.
It's
not a fandom picture.
I think
isn't.
Some of these people had people were fans.
Right.
And I think they became much bigger fans after these experiences, too, because it just kind of reinforces what they thought they liked about him. And kind of, again, we have this idea of celebrity. And it's probably more of an idea than a reality most of the times. And I think the nice part about Bill is there really isn't a much of a difference between the two. And I think that's what really sticks out with people and is surprising to people.
Well said. Yeah. I knew I hadn't chosen my words. I wasn't trying to suggest, and I did, that, you know, these were like both, they were seeking him out. He just sort of showed up. They had nothing to do with it. They just happened to.
Well, that's what makes it so
lucky.
Great.
Yeah. Be kind of lucky or serendipitous. It was a serendipitous thing. I just want to start to wind it down because we're at this festival and everybody's got food to order.
She's taking care of that.
I know, I'm sure. So you yourself, though, Tommy, director, you wanted really to try to connect with Bill in some fashion or other, right?
Yeah, I mean, we did reach out to him throughout the movie. He does not have a manager. He does not have an agent. He has a 1-800 number.
Yeah. I had one of his directors on. And he told me great story. Yeah, Ted Malfi. That's
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very good.
He was the first person to say, I won't be interviewed for your movie. But we know he's a good dude. We had a mutual friend, and he said, you know, everyone, you know, across the board was like, this sounds like a fun project, but, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I understand. That's a challenging film you made. You know?
I mean, it's always tough to sit anyone down and, you know, ask their time and do these sort of interviews. We had produced a movie that played Tribeca 2 years ago called Ghost Heads, all about Ghostbuster fans.
Oh.
And it was like the most weirdest thing when Ivan Reitman, Dan Aykroyd's person was like, can we be involved? It's like, who is this? You know, like, that thing doesn't really happen. You know, we have, for the Bill Murray stories, Life Lessons Learned by a Mythical Man, we do have Peter Farley, Fairley.
Mm-hmm.
And Joel Murray in the movie. You know,
right.
So
yes.
Mixed in with a couple experts. Absolutely. That like study this philosophy of Bill Murray from CNN and Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair.
Yeah. No, any Bill Murray fan will enjoy the film. Any Bill Murray fan will enjoy the film. You know, they'll be able to relate. It's a lot of fun. We were there. What's next? I know is this the world premiere? Here at South by Southwest?
It is our world premiere. Uh-huh. We're playing again tonight, and then we have a couple, like one more screening a couple
of days
from now.
And then what's coming up after that? After that, do you have a...
For Bill Murray?
For your doc, yeah.
Well, we'll sell it, you know, and then we'll find out where it will go.
Okay. I didn't know if you had another festival maybe already in the works.
Oh, yeah. We're playing Hot Docs.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Yes. I may see you there.
Perfect. Yeah. There's fantastic. There's a lot of great movies out there. There's like that, the Mr. Rogers.
I know. Morgan Neville's film. And it's a good year.
Yeah. I'm excited. I think the Mr. I'm plugging someone else's movie. I think the Mr. Rogers movie is playing this festival, but we didn't really sync up. But Hot Docs, I'm just excited to see Love Gilda and Will You Be My Neighbor? That's a great thing about these things. It's there's so many good documentaries right now about interesting takes on people that it's very important to us that we didn't want to make a biography on Bill Murray. It was these Bill Murray stories were, I thought, what was important, you know?
Yeah, this is in a way his legacy as much as his film work, you know?
Exactly.
It's interesting, yeah.
Derek has one last thing to say.
Oh, please, Derek.
The movie was called Wild Things.
Wild Things. It's not a great movie. Bill's great in it.
No, it's a good example of the other tier of Bill Murray movies where he just kind of is there and kills it, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of the same way in Charlie's Angels, for the record, if you remember that,
too.
Oh,
I never saw Charlie's Angels.
You should. It's a good move.
Just a couple seconds.
I forgot about that. That's right.
Oh, right, yeah.
What? What's that?
Well, we need a microphone. Go ahead.
Yes.
All right. The Bill Murray Stories movie.com. There we go.
Good plug. Good
should
plug.
Always try to plug that, huh?
Okay, so thank you guys.
Thank you.
Max,
thank you very much.
Tommy, Dirk, and
Bill. Are you now going to talk to the waitress?
Bill, I was going to say, and please, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, tip your waiters and waitresses.
Thank you.
Gary Owens reference. All righty, guys. Thank you very much. Good luck with everything.
Thick cloud, steam rising, hissing stone on sweat lunch fire. Around me, buffalo robe. Sage and bundle rub on skin. Outside, cold air. Stand, wait for rising sun.
Alrighty. Up here last is Amir Motlagh, who is a Los Angeles-based filmmaker. If you are in the Chicago area this coming weekend, on April 21st, two of Amir's films, Man and Three Worlds, both of which I recently saw and really enjoyed, will be screened as a double feature with the Chicago Filmmakers Organization. You can go to chicagofilmmakers.org/screenings, and you'll see under the 21st there, there is a $10 suggested donation. Screenings begin at 6:30 after a 6 o'clock reception with Amir. Get to meet him and mention me, and they'll charge you $11. No, there's a $10 suggested fee. But check out Amir Motlagh. You can look up his website and his work. Some of his work is available. You can check out trailers and other clips and shorter works online. One of the reasons I do this podcast, it's not just to bring on Hollywood. It's for people like Amir who are doing, I don't know, he's doing this work for the pure passion of making films. And you can see it in his refreshing and original approach to filmmaking. My conversation with filmmaker Amir Motlagh.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Yeah. What are you rocking back there, bro? You got a couple of that. You have a bass. No, that's a guitar. And I see three guitars.
A bass. There's three guitars. There's the pedals. Uh-huh. Some preamps.
My old Fender Twin.
That's part of the, how do you pronounce, M-I-R-S? Is that pronounced, or is that supposed to be an act?
It's pronounced Mears.
Mears.
Actually, we're recording a new record right now.
You should send it over when you have tracks, because I can use it to, you know, like interstitially or otherwise. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. You know, I've got a ton of stuff already, but yeah, for sure.
No, I do that. Okay, yeah, send over any music you want to. Like, I can include it in the episode or in some other episode. Even I do it all the time. I love music, and it's also, you know, one of my sort of passions. So I try to help folks out who are trying to make music, you know. And you're in Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Right, of course. And what neighborhood?
Downtown.
Okay. And so when I'm watching your films, am I seeing essentially your neighborhood and your home?
We're seeing some of it. Those are the ones that you saw are half of them take place in Laurel Canyon.
Yeah, it looks like Laurel Canyon. Then it,
right.
Yeah.
Which is an area I was living. And then some of them take place in an area in the suburbs where I grew up.
Oh, okay.
California.
Oh, so you grew up in California?
I did, yeah.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about yourself and, you know, you're finding your way to being a storyteller or a filmmaker and artist.
Sure, yeah. I guess
the origin story.
Yeah, the origin story. Basically, I was pretty much a very rebellious teenager and doing all sorts of shit. And
okay, slow down.
Yeah, going too fast.
Let's get specific.
Yeah, so,
I'm kidding around. It's up to you. You don't have to.
No, I mean, basically, you know, I didn't really have a path, so I got involved in acting.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's the dark backstory of Amir Motlagh.
Totally, but you know, that didn't last long. Okay. I was being sent out a lot, and you know, they wanted me to fucking play a terrorist and, you know, do these reads, and I was like, you know what, it's not my thing. And at the same time, like, I had seen John Cassavetes' retrospective, right?
Okay, so what year roughly are we talking about?
So this would be sometime in the early 2000s. And my mom is a giant cinephile. So
So when you were growing up, she was watching stuff at home, or would she drag you to the movie theaters?
Yeah, both, but she's really into, you know, all the French stuff.
Right. So, like, she really liked Truffaut and...
She loved, yeah, Truffaut, but then things like Mike Leigh and...
okay, my favorite stuff.
And, I mean, all of that. All of the kind of core elemental filmmakers.
Right.
So, it was like ancillary, like it was always in my world, but it wasn't something I was into until...
you discovered Cassavetes.
Yeah, and coming from an acting background, because I went through the whole thing. Like, I did the Stella Adler stuff, I did the Meisner stuff, Stanislavski stuff. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like seeing that stuff, seeing Cassavetes. I saw Husbands in the theater, and it just blew me away, man. Like,
I'm a little older, of course, and I grew up in a time when they were coming out. It kind of, I mean, I was probably too young. But I had seen them all and also fell in love with his films as I mean, you know, of all the filmmakers, I'd say his name comes up, like, as a reference probably more often than almost any filmmaker, you know, as an influence, as a icon, you know. But I just remember there was one movie, I had seen them all over the course of many years, and there had been one more movie I hadn't seen of all of it, because, you know, he died, and I hadn't seen Love Streams.
Love Streams, yeah.
And I had been holding off in a way because, you know, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but, you know, you have this filmmaker you love, and they've stopped making films for whatever reason. And, you know, once you've seen everything, there's no more to look forward to, right?
Sure.
You know, so I finally at BAM here in Brooklyn, I don't know if you know BAM, but they did a retrospective as well, and... they were showing Love Streams. So I could not put it off anymore. You know what
correct,
I'm saying?
Because
it was on the big, big, beautiful screen. And I had to go see Love Streams. And it was painful because not only because I was crossing off the last of them off my list, but because also it was his last film, I think, at least completed film, and he was clearly ill and in bad health, and you could see it. And so it was hard to watch for that reason, too.
Right. Yeah. That was the whole thing with Madonna and Sean Penn about that, about Love Streams.
I don't remember that. Tell me.
I kind of forgot the details, but basically Sean Penn wanted Madonna in the film, and Cassavetes was like, no, fuck this. I don't want her in the film, and there was this whole ordeal about it.
Good.
It's kind of something that I remember.
No, good. Well, first of all, you know, I didn't even know that Sean Penn was around. I didn't know they knew each other, but I'm glad. I mean, not because of necessarily because of Madonna's track record, which hasn't been very good, but because she doesn't belong in that sphere. Nor does he. Nor does he. And even though I respect his body of work, but I don't think he belongs in the Cassavetes world.
Yeah, I mean, I generally agree too. I think he had this thing with Terrence Malick too for Tree of Life, where he comes from a kind of that kind of core generation where they need all this kind of extraneous material, right, to build these kind of characters. But Malick is into something else. Like he's like operating on a different level, and I can see where those kind of clashes occur.
It was Malick another one of your guys?
Yeah, I mean, my guys, I would say, like, it's like Chris Marker, Malick for sure, Ozu, and then the Iranian dudes, you know, Kiarostami, Mahmoud Malbouf. Those are guys kind of, I gear towards a lot of the Japanese cinema and the Iranian cinema, stuff that I'm really into.
Yeah. Is it maybe because they're less caught up with linear or traditional structure?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, that's partly it. You know, I just feel like a lot of those guys operate on a different wavelength and they are removed from the strict kind of hierarchy of narrative, right? So where here we have a lot of repetition in our cinema structurally. In those areas, especially Iran during the 90s, early 2000s, when they were really experimenting, but they had the censorship, they had to kind of come up with their own rules, right? The rules of the structure. And so you get really unique cinema that's just kind of like, for me, it's kind of core truths. That's really where it's at. And I think those guys express it really well. I think the Japanese also do that too, especially somebody like Ozu, who was basically making the same film every year for his whole thing. So there's a lot of context built into that. But I think, you know, one thing about Ozu is that those films to me last, like time-wise. And so if you look at one of his works from the 50s, to me, it feels much more relevant than a lot of the other stuff I'll watch from the 50s, which seem archaic sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so those are people I like.
Mm.
And then Chris Marker, of course, who was doing really fascinating stuff.
Yeah. I bet you like Agnes Varda, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, he's kind of more on the experimental side for me.
Yeah, very much so.
Which I gravitate more towards early experimental, but not necessarily experimental in the way that they are taken in.
Mm-hmm.
So that they have, I guess that's the easiest way for me to describe that.
So when did you realize filmmaking was going to be your way into that?
You know, it's just one of those things where it's like I had access to the camera when a lot of people didn't. Basically, we had an in with somebody, like some big corporation like Time Warner. It was like an intern there, so we were able to grab all their gear at night, you know, and, without them knowing and shoot. And so I was like, hell, this is like the DV revolution. So we had a mini DV camera. I had been seeing all this Cassavetes stuff, so I'm like, let me just try to go and make some stuff, see what happens, you know?
Yeah. Well, I got to see two recent projects that you did, I guess, Man, which I think, you know, definitely speaks to the films we're talking about, that the we are the camera.
Right.
Right? That's, you know, so you're kind of, it's like the course of a day, maybe? It is
exactly a course of the day, yeah.
And again, we are the point of view, the POV is the camera. It's kind of intrigued. I mean, that was the first thing I watched, and then I thought, okay, yeah, I'm going to talk. I want to know what this guy is about, because I really enjoyed it, because I asked to be transported on some level, you know, taken out of my normal perspective or comfort zone or what have you.
Right.
Oh, it happened today, by the way. I just want to mention, it's still lingering in my body and my mind, and I saw the Paul Schrader film, First Reformed. I don't know if you know about it, but it's,
no.
You know who Paul Schrader is? But, yeah, I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot. It's, you know, he has a new film, and it's coming out in May, and it was like the first press screening was today, and I got to see it, and it was pretty spectacular, and it was pretty intense, you know.
Right.
I appreciate any time where. And it happened also a couple of weeks ago with the Lynn Ramsey movie, and I just had her on the podcast.
Mm.
So I'm all of a sudden, I've been feeling good of the number of films I'm seeing. It's great. It's a great feeling. Yeah, it's a great feeling that not only because I'm experiencing it, but because these films are coming out, you know, that are, they're less commercial in a way, which, you know, and sometimes commercial movies do it too. I don't know how often maybe you go to commercial movies, but it's more often than not going to be in the most commercial, you know,
sure,
context,
right,
where you get transcendent experience.
Right, right. Yeah, I think, you know, there's two aspects about how we, mm-hmm. Charles and I, as my producer, co-writer, and man, developed that.
Charles
and,
who?
Charles Borg. So there is the concept of mononullware,
sure,
which was very, very important in this. And then the other thing is a concept called Shoshin, which is beginner's mind, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were trying to figure out what we can use the tools that we have to get an audience into a meditative state, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not through some sort of trickery, just through rhythm, flow, and sequencing. And I think that helps. I mean, you have to have an audience who's willing
open
to
it, right? Who's open to whatever experience, right?
Sure.
That's the trickiest thing of all, of course, because
most
of the time the audience is being fooled and into this other direction where, you know, they're not being really engaged in that way. But
right.
I don't mean to be cynical about it. It just happens to be true.
Yeah. And, you know, and then the other thing is that we flip the POV concept, because POV is mostly a tool used in something like action sports. It's kind of like novelty, things that happen really fast, and cuts and all that, and kind of we tailored it into the other end of the spectrum, the other end of just the flow of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I saw Man, and I saw, what was the other one? I saw the...
Three Worlds?
Third World. Is that what, three, was it?
Three Worlds, yeah.
Three Worlds, yeah, exactly. Is that the most recent project? Or?
That would be the most recent, right.
Yeah. Now talk about that, because you also incorporate first person, not confessionals. It's a very reality television way of describing it.
Right.
But how would you describe kind of you intermittent or interstitial?
There is a hybrid doc element to it.
Yeah.
That weaves into. So the three worlds is structured where you have three worlds actually occurring. And so you have real life, you have a narrative. Narrative one level, and then you have the film within the film, let's say contextually level three,
mm-hmm.
and they all try to intertwine and weave together,
mm-hmm.
to have some sort of a coherent whole to it.
Mm. Now, are you thinking when you make these films about how to get them in front of audiences very, very specifically? You and Charles, are you thinking about the festivals where maybe you might find the most receptive audiences of all?
This is a tough one, because it's one of those things where it's like, you know, both of these are a reaction to me to having other more mainstream type projects fall through the cracks,
mm-hmm.
and going, you know what, fuck it, I don't want to go through a development cycle and then have everything fall underneath me and then have nothing at the end of this. So I'm like, let me just go back to my roots, what I really love to do, mm-hmm. start building these things. And the audience, yeah, is definitely a secondary consideration mm-hmm. here. But again, you know, we did strive to not make it alienating as much as possible in both of these projects.
Right. Well, I do. I think most people are in agreement that ideally, if you're making art that's an organic process, you know, you do start with purely from what's exciting you or what's preoccupying you, you know, and then, you know, you think about, I guess, the commercial sort of component to it afterward. Now, a lot of people, of course, don't really do that. You know, they're kind of thinking more practically, perhaps, but I think, you know, when I, you know, especially here where I talk to a lot of people that kind of go back and forth with that. So it's, mm-hmm. I don't think it's unusual to try to do some work that's commercially motivated. So,
sure.
You know, you do have some options to do your own less commercial projects,
right.
I guess.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
As you're trying to figure out this career and this kind of, you know, transactional career that you're trying to, you know,
right.
get off
right.
the ground. But it seems like you're pretty prolific in that. Maybe because you are doing it in your way.
Right. I mean, that's part of it. And, you know, again, I mean, I have two concurrent streams going with, you know, the projects that we have written, the scripts that we have and all that stuff. And then this uh-huh. stuff that I do like to be regular about producing work that I really love, looking at new ideas. And a lot of my inspiration just comes from the fact that we're in kind of such a digital space. And there was this web, this world of the web, sucking some energy out of traditional 2D cinema, right? And it's kind of these new forms are appearing and all this stuff is happening. And I like to pull a lot from that world as well.
Yeah. Talk about your most recent project then, which is, it sounds like it's also, it's not, it's like a, what are you calling it? It's an EP that you're done sort of an art video project around. Correct?
No, so these two would be, so this all...
Are you correcting me?
Yeah, so Man in Three Worlds and then Canyon. All part of the trilogy. Canyon was released in 2016.
Okay, but is that all music with subtitles, I guess we call it?
Yes, correct, right.
And the music is all beautiful, though. You composed it?
Yeah, that's for Mirrors. I did have a partner, Nima Rezai, on that as well.
Okay.
So, and then those are all kind of, you know, using the form in different ways. All the films kind of have similar thematics, and they kind of have little Easter eggs inside each, kind of weave into each other, whether it's location, some sort of character device, some sort of subtitle device.
Mm-hmm.
They have all these little parts working together.
And so, is this going to have a presentation or screening or?
No, Canyon went straight on the web.
Oh, did? Okay, very good.
Yeah, straight on the web. The EP is available on all the platforms, you know, which is, you know, the last four, five years, I've been just releasing straight to web.
Right.
Not doing festivals anymore after maybe 2013. I kind of just veered off more into how people just deal with music these days, right? And
right. No, it makes total sense. So I'm just kind of curious. I don't mean to sound cynical because, you know, it's not my business really, but I am curious. So you're not no longer as commercially motivated then with the film work?
I am.
Okay.
I am. But
it would make sense that you were. You know, I'm just trying to kind of also get to how you're figuring it all out. It's interesting to me.
Yeah, no, we have several commercial IPs ready to go.
Uh-huh.
You know, so if I get the call,
totally.
The call, we're ready to go. We're ready to get that stuff out the way and make some beautiful work on that level as well.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm not going to wait for that phone call either, even though I'm doing inputs that I need to do.
Right.
So, you know, hopefully some of this stuff leads to, you know, it's kind of like, what would be a good example of that? I mean, Gus Van Sant was kind of doing that for a little while.
Sure. Oh, I know what you mean. When he was shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a number of artists who are kind of like on a, let's call it for accessibility wise, we'll call it DIY because people understand that term. Sure. And I would definitely put that there. I mean, there are even very large artists, like I was talking to somebody else about, even musicians like Prince and David Bowie, who have done stuff kind of DIY. Now, they do have a built-in enormous audience, so it's you know, they have that option, but it doesn't make it any more valid.
Right, totally, yeah. Yeah, so that's kind of that model is where my streams, I eventually want these things to converge, right? So yeah. I've been working more at converging these disparate pieces that I'm doing, right? So, you know, the film and music, they're kind of merging into like this more cohesive whole. Uh-huh. And so they're not so separated as they used to be.
Right. So how can folks that are interested in seeing your films, what's the best way to?
So the first preview screening we have right now for both those films is coming up 4/21 at Chicago Filmmakers. That's going to be the first time if this airs by then.
Well, we will make sure it does.
Yeah, so that'll be the first time those two films will be screened for an audience. And then...
You're talking about, again, Man and Three Worlds.
Yes, correct.
And so that, where's Chicago Filmmakers? What's that?
Chicago Filmmakers is an organization up in Chicago that puts on screening events, and I guess they have this whole other...
So it's a Chicago film community-driven...
Yes.
So like
yes.
Almost like a film society, it sounds like.
Kind of, yeah, absolutely.
Sort of.
And Charles is based out in Chicago, so it kind of works out.
Oh, okay.
He'll be handling that event.
Where's that taking place for people that are listening? Do you know where that is? We can put it in the description, so don't have to worry.
Yeah. I don't know exactly know where it is. But
right. You're in Los Angeles. Why would you know? If I asked you where the Lemley NoHo 7 was, you'd know that. But
right. So what I want is to basically what would be really good is if I can take these films to different cities as a double feature. I feel like that's the best way to go about it. But, you know,
yeah.
The other concurrent thing is to try a festival run with one or both.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I mean, we've had several distribution offers, so that's another area that I can go. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if I want to do that yet. Maybe take a bit of time before I jump into that.
Right. Well, you know, let's continue the dialogue and you know, let's do another one soon when you know, whatever, just keep going. I have no idea when people send me their films. I get stuff that's a little, you know, the complete spectrum of stuff. And all I'm looking for is something that's kind of soulful. You know what I mean? That's honest and soulful. And I did have that response to your work. So that's why I was happy to be introduced to you.
Excellent. That's great. That's great to hear.
So good luck to you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Stay in touch.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Ab.
All right. Great. All right. Nice meeting you, Amir.
Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
Many thanks, everybody. Please do remember to subscribe on iTunes, subscribe on Stitcher. You can leave star ratings and reviews, I think, under both or either of those platforms. You can also join and follow us on YouTube, where we put up every segment for every episode is going up on our YouTube channel. If you go to YouTube and search FilmWax, it'll come up. And I'm also creating playlists. So, for instance, we had on last episode Jeremy Workman, our friend, and he's been on 4 times. Well, there's a Jeremy Workman playlist. You can listen to all 4 segments over the last couple of years that Jeremy's appeared on the show in order. You can listen to, for instance, Hal Hartley's been on several times. You can listen to all of Hal Hartley's visits on the Hal Hartley on FilmWax Radio playlist. So subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can subscribe to our newsletter right off the website. Contact me. Let me know what you think of the show. Let me know what you think, who should be on the show. Anything, any reason at all. Feel free to reach out. I do try to get back to everybody as quickly as I can. If I don't, please forgive me and just follow up, and I promise I will stay in touch. Thank you very much, everybody. Please take care of yourselves and the ones you love. Until next time, this is Adam Chartoff, host of FilmWax Radio. Take care.